States, and we are in our 44th year, and you are at the Folklife Area stage, which the theme this year for the entire festival is storytelling, and we're very pleased to have with us this morning a woman named Linda Spitzer. She's from Miami, Florida. That's where she lives now, but she really is a native Floridian, and that's kind of a rare thing. You were born in Orlando, correct? She is a professional Jewish educator, and she told me just 5 minutes ago that she got into storytelling in order to educate her students. And she has just recently received a degree in storytelling from Eastern Tennessee State University, and that is the only university that gives a degree in storytelling, and I think that's wonderful, and I congratulate you for that degree. Let's welcome Linda Spitzer to our Folklife Area stage.
Well, I need a microphone that's on, otherwise I'll step to that one. No, it isn't. Is it on now? No, it's not on.
It is? Oh, see, that now I can hear it. Okay. All right. Well, I come from a tradition that I think is a folk culture, too, because Jewish people have different ways of expressing themselves. And there are Jews who are very, very traditional, and they think that the way to get into their spirituality is through prayer. And then another man came along in the 1800s, the Baal Shem Tov, who felt that you could get into your spirituality by singing, by dancing, by storytelling. And that's kind of where I fit in. I'm not traditional. I do teach children, and I observe a lot of the things in the Jewish tradition. But my main love is teaching the faith and the lessons through storytelling. And I think that's working really well with my students. And, of course, I tell stories to adult groups all the time, too, as well as multicultural folktales from all over the world. One thing that the Baal Shem Tov taught Jews that couldn't take the time to study the Torah, the holy book, if they could just reach God through singing, and the singing didn't even have to have words of prayer. So I'm going to give you an example, one of my favorite stories, and in it I incorporate some of the things of our faith. One night, when I was spending the night in Claremont, Florida with my grandfather, I heard him singing a song at our Sabbath meal, our Shabbos meal, that I'd never heard before. It went like this. Ya la la, ya la la, ya la 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 la, ya la la, ya la la, ya la 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 la. I said, Grandpa, I've never heard you sing that. And I go to Hebrew school. I never heard that. It's called a niggun, Linda. It's a tune without words. And I learned it from your Uncle Moshe. And I'm going to tell you how I happened to learn it. You see, I came to America many years before your Uncle Moshe. He was still in Eastern Europe with your Aunt Etka and my parents, Sarah, Devorah, and Joseph. One Friday, he went every Friday to get the Shabbos candlesticks, the Shabbos candles, the challah breads, and the wine that you have to have for the Sabbath meal. Well, my mother did not like the baker in Belchito. She made Moshe go all the way into the next village, and he had to pass through a little forest. So after he'd bought the challah breads and the wine and the candles, he came back through the forest, and he heard a klezmer band. Now, if you've never heard klezmer, it's Jewish soul music. It's an accordion and a clarinet and a tambourine and a fiddle. It could be anything, but it's really toe-tapping music. He heard a tune. He couldn't get the tune out of his mind. And so he said, I've got to learn that tune. And he walked right back into the forest, even though he was almost all the way home. He said, teach me that tune. Sure, said the klezmer band, but you know, we are professionals. We get paid for this. First you have to pay. But I don't have any money left. All I have is the wine. Will you take the wine? Sure, said the band. And so they taught Uncle Moshe the tune. And he was so happy. He walked all the way back to his house in Belchitow, singing the tune so he wouldn't forget. Oh! Just then he tripped. There was a low branch and it hit him in the head and he turned upside down and he got up and brushed himself off, ready to sing again. Yai la la yai la la la. He could not remember the tune. Well, I'll just go back and learn the tune again. And so he went into the forest, and there was the klezmer band. Teach me the tune again, I forgot. Well, first you have to pay. Well, I don't have anything left but the challah breads. Will you take the challah breads? Challah are twisted loaves of yellow bread that served especially on the Sabbath to make it a more festive meal instead of the hard, brown, dry, black bread. So he handed them the two challah breads, and they taught him the tune again. And he walked on home, practicing it so he wouldn't forget. Ya la la ya la la ya la 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 ya la la ya la la ya la 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 ya la la ya la la ya. Oh! He tripped and he fell over a root of a tree. And when he got up and brushed himself off, he tried to sing the tune again. Ya la la ya la la ya la 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 la. He couldn't remember. He walked all the way back into the forest. He said, please teach me the tune again. I forgot it. Sure, said the klezmer band, but first you have to pay. Well, all I have left are the candles. Can you use the candles? Sure, we can use candles. We need them to light up the place. And so they taught him the tune again, and this time Uncle Moshe came home, and he walked very carefully so he wouldn't trip or bump into anything. But Sarah Devora was sitting there saying, Moshe, where are the candles and the wine and the challah breads we need for the Shabbos dinner? Oh, Mother, I've got something much better for you this Shabbos. Wait till you hear what I'm going to teach you. Well, they sat down with a beautiful tablecloth. It was a special meal that night, and the finest dishes, and the roast chicken, and the carrot simis, and the matzo ball soup, and they had a fine dinner with gefilte fish and apple strudel. And after dinner, they said, all right, Moshe, what have you got? He says, I've got a new niggun, and I'm going to teach it to you. Now, you've heard it a few times, so if you feel like joining in, go right ahead. This is the tune, the niggun, that Moshe taught his family. Yai la la, yai la la, yai la 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 la, yai la la, yai la la, yai la 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 la. They loved it. Sarah Devora liked it so much. Sunday, when the butcher shop opened, she sang it to everyone in the butcher shop. And the children, when they went to school, they taught all the kids at school. Well, things were very bad in Poland in the 1800s, the late 1800s, the early 1900s. So Jews had to leave Eastern Europe. They came to America. They went to Israel. They went to France. They went to Australia. They went to Mexico. They went anywhere that they could go. And everywhere they went by boat, they taught everyone on the boat the niggun because they had just learned it. So by the next Friday night, Jews all over the world were singing Moshe's niggun. Yai la la, yai la la, yai la 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 la, yai la la, yai la la, yai la 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 la. And so my grandfather explained to me, Linda, that's how I learned the niggun, and now I'm teaching it to you. And I just taught it to you. On your schedules, you were supposed to see two young girls, Tiffany Knowles and Maria Telechea. They could not come because children get sick. And they had fever. One of them had fever. And they have just come back from the Junior Storytelling Olympics. Storytelling has become an art and a profession. And I have been coaching these girls. They go to school where there are a lot of student storytellers. And they won the regional finals. And then they went up to the finals. And Tiffany Knowles, an eighth grader in Miami, became the national winner of the Junior Storytelling Olympics. I'm sorry you didn't hear either of the girls. They are wonderful storytellers, and they will perpetuate the love and the art of storytelling all their lives. And so that's what I hope to instill not only in my students, but in grown-ups as well. This is another one of my favorite stories. And then if you have questions to ask about any of the traditions that are mentioned in the story, I am, you know, happy to answer any of your questions. You may think that when you tell somebody something, they understand perfectly well what you mean. But oftentimes, two people can be talking about the same thing and completely misunderstand each other, and that's where this story comes in. For hundreds of years, the Jews had lived in Italy. And then for some reason, there was a proclamation that they were going to be kicked out of town. I don't know what happened. Either the economy went downhill, or maybe a Christian child had been found murdered and it was blamed on the Jewish community, which often happened in those days. So the Jewish community was called out on the carpet and said, "You will have to be leaving town. You can't stay here anymore." The Jews didn't know what to do. They'd been in that community for hundreds of years. Where were they to go? They'd never lived anyplace else. So a group of rabbis decided that they would go to the king and they would ask to see if he could do anything in their behalf. They had been very helpful to the king as moneylenders. And the king said, "Well, frankly, this is a political situation. There's not much I can do to help you. Of course, there could be a debate." "A debate?" said the rabbis. "We're very good at debates. What would the debate be about?" "Well, it would probably be a biblical debate." "The Bible? We're very good at the Bible. We're called the people of the book." "What would the debate be about?" "Well, I don't know, but I can tell you this. The debate will take place in sign language."
"Sign language? What do we know about sign language?"
"Well, that's your problem," said the king. "The debate will take place in 30 days. And if you don't find anyone who knows sign language, well, you're going to get kicked out of town. And if you do find somebody and they don't know sign language, well, you're going to be kicked out of town anyway." It sounded like a lose-lose situation. The rabbis knew no one who spoke sign language, so they quickly went back to the synagogue and held a meeting. No one came forward who knew sign language. They explained the situation that they were going to be kicked out of town unless somebody came forward who could debate with the king in sign language. No one came forward. 1 week passed, no one came forward. 2 weeks, 3 weeks, no one came forward. And no one wanted it on their head that they lost the debate and got the Jews kicked out of town. So no one came forward for that reason either. Finally, the 4 weeks was almost up, and the Jews had to have another prayer meeting and fast. "God, please, aren't you listening? Send us someone who knows sign language." No one came forward. At about that time, Muddle, who'd been a chicken farmer, was out in the countryside selling his chickens, selling his eggs. He came back into town, and he saw his wife and his children crying.
"What's the matter? Did someone die?"
"Oh, that's right. You've been out of town. You don't know what's happened. We're going to be kicked out of town unless someone can talk the language of sign and debate with the king. If we don't have anyone, we've got to leave."
"Well, I'll go," said Muddle.
"You? What do you know about sign language? Wise men in the village have not even come forward to say they know sign language. You're just a chicken farmer."
"I know, but if nobody goes, we're going to be kicked out of town anyway. I might as well at least try. You never know."
Sure enough, the 30-day period ended, and there was a big platform that the king had built in the middle of the town. And there was the king on the platform.
He was an imposing figure in his royal purple robes.
The Jews were on one side, and the king's advisors were on the other side of the platform. Muddle, in his little overalls, slumped up the stairs and met the king on the stage. And the king walked over to Muddle and faced him squarely in the face.
and he raised a hand outstretched with a thumb in the air.
Muddle looked around. There was a lot of hubbub in the crowd, and he looked around to see what they were talking about. Maybe they could help him. He hadn't the vaguest idea what this meant, and he scratched his head. And suddenly he had an idea. He reached his hand up, and he stuck his thumb downward. Perspiration broke out on the king's forehead. He was completely upset. It looked like Muddle had come up with the right answer. When he composed himself, the king walked right back in front of Muddle, and he held up a fist. And he held up five fingers out of the fist. Muddle looked at the five fingers, and again there was whispering behind him all his friends. And he scratched his head, and he looked. And then he held up a hand, and he stretched out a fist. And he held it there. Well, the king's face turned red. Beads of perspiration broke out. He was so upset that he had to go sit down. When he composed himself again, he got straight up. He walked straight in front of Muddle. He reached deep inside his purple robe, and he brought out a piece of moldy cheese, and he held it up in front of Muddle's face. This time there was a lot of whispering among the crowd. They didn't know what was going on. And Muddle looked very, very puzzled. But he was wearing a little rope belt, and he had a sack attached to the belt. He reached deep in the sack. He pulled out a hard-boiled egg. He held it up in front of the king's face. The king looked at it, threw up his hands, and he said, "I give up. The Jews have won the debate. They get to stay in town another generation." And he stomped off the stage. Well, this was the most jubilant day in the history of the Jewish population of that village. They literally picked Muddle up on their shoulders, and they carried him back to the synagogue. In the meantime, the king and his advisors walked back to the palace. And the advisors said, "How could you let that nothing of a chicken farmer win a debate with you? We don't understand sign language. Tell us what went on." The king said, "Oh, that was not just a chicken farmer. That man had the most brilliant theological mind I have ever known." "Well, what did he say?" said the advisors. "Tell us what went on." "Well, first I told him that it's in heaven above where paradise is, and all our actions count to make us be able to go to paradise." And Muddle said, "No, it's down here on earth that our actions count. The good that we do for other people, that's what's important." And you know, he was very wise, and he was very right. And then I said to him, "The Jews are scattered all over in other countries, and so you are a weak people." And he differed with me. He said, "No, the Jews are united as one people. They think alike and act as a strong people." How right again. And then I wanted to trick him. So I showed him a piece of cheese, and I said, "All right, what color goat produced this cheese? A white goat or a black goat?" And he was so smart. He pulled out an egg and he said, "Well, what color chicken produced this egg? A white chicken or a brown chicken?" So he won the debate, and I had to let them go. Back at the synagogue, a different explanation went on. "Muddle, what happened? You won the debate. We're so happy. But tell us what went on. We don't understand sign language." "I don't know. It was over so fast. It was over before it began. I really don't know what happened." "Well, what did the king say?" "I don't know. First he said, 'We've got to get out of town.' And I said, 'No, we're staying.' And then he said, 'He's going to hit me in the face.' And I said, 'If you do, I'll punch you back.' And then I guess he gave up and thought I was winning because he took out his lunch, so I took out mine." So often you may think that what you have communicated is totally understood, but the person listening to it has a different explanation. Thank you. Are there any questions that you have? Sometimes people think that, you know, something in a story isn't what they thought I meant or what you understand. So please, you know, just raise your hand or ask a question. Otherwise, I'll just keep telling stories. There's a mechanism, I don't know what it is, that we have It's called a midrash. And the rabbis have found in the Bible that things are left between the lines. They're not explained. Like, for instance, when Abraham takes Isaac up to the Mount Moriah to, you know, before the angel comes and stops him, there's nothing said between Abraham and Sarah. And so rabbis have made up stories of a conversation that could have taken place. Or if they want to teach the children about a specific commandment, they make up a story because children understand the language of stories so much better. Let me give you an example of a story I just told to the children. There's a commandment that says you shall not bow down to idols. And then the rabbis have gone on with a more explanation that not only do you not bow down to idols, but religious Jews can't draw pictures of people because then the people would be idolized. If you don't know why nobody knows where Moses is buried, it's because if people knew, they might come to his gravesite and make him, they could bow down to the grave. So that's just not allowed in the Jewish religion. Nor is being part of making an idol. So this is how this story was invented. The rabbis wrote many of these. There's whole books of these stories in what we call the Talmud. We have the Torah, which are the five books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And then that's the Torah. It's just those five books. And the children read a portion of that every week, and we have like a little lesson on it. And that's what a bar mitzvah is. They are reading that portion of the week. But there's a book called the Talmud that's like a dictionary for the Torah. It's an encyclopedia for the Torah. And they've taken four very famous rabbis and given their explanations of each line practically. And since there's four different explanations, the rabbis have had to learn all four and debate which one they think is what piece of what. So if you've noticed there's a lot of Jewish lawyers, it's because it comes from our tradition of learning the Talmud, where you've had to argue and say, no, this rabbi really meant this, and this rabbi has a better explanation. I like that. So the whole thing of debating is really very much a part of Jewish tradition. It's been going on for thousands of years. So this story I told about 2 weeks ago, the portion of the Torah was about not bowing to idols. I think it's the second commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me, I think is what it says. Rabbi Isaac was a very well-known rabbi in town. But he was not only well known for the good things he did for people, but because for generations he'd been known to have something he inherited, a huge, precious diamond. It was so large that all the colors of the rainbow shone through that diamond. Everybody in town knew he had it because it had been passed down through his family for hundreds of years. One day, the king, that town, had a statue in the palace that was of a crocodile. And the eyes of the crocodile were two huge diamonds. One day his servant noticed that one of the diamonds was missing. King, the diamond is missing from the eye of the crocodile. You must get another one.
Well, you know what I'll do? I know where to get another diamond. That Rabbi Isaac, he's got a big diamond I've heard about. Guard, go over to Rabbi Isaac's house and go bring back that diamond. Sure enough, the guard showed up at Rabbi Isaac's house. And he said, the king wants you to come and bring your diamond. He needs it for his statue, the one of the crocodile. What could Rabbi Isaac do? He had to get in the carriage with the guard. But all the way on that ride, he was thinking of how he could trick the king so he wouldn't have to give up the diamond because of the commandment, thou shalt not make any idols before me. Finally, he said, guard, please stop. My legs are cramped. I got to stretch them. The guard didn't think anything about it. He said, sure, it's been a long ride. I'll let you out. So Isaac got out. And he took the pouch that had the diamond, and he started holding it up to the sun, and he said to the guard, would you like to hold my diamond? Would you like to see it for yourself up close?
Oh, I would really like to see that diamond, and I promise I won't smudge it. Just let me hold it.
As the guard took hold of the diamond, Rabbi Isaac pretended to trip, and as he tripped, he hit the hand of the guard, and the diamond flew, and it didn't land on the ground. Rabbi Isaac purposely had placed the guard next to a lake. The diamond flew into the lake and landed in the middle, and they couldn't retrieve the diamond. The guard started to cry. What was he going to tell the king? Isaac started to cry because he had given up his diamond, and that was the only value that he had. He had nothing worth anything as valuable as that diamond.
What will we tell the king? Said the guard.
Well, I think we ought to tell him the truth.
But he'll cut off our heads. That's what kings do, you know.
Well, we'll have to take our chances. Rabbi Isaac went with the guard, and they said to the king,
We had an accident on the way here. I was looking at the diamond, and it flew out of my hands and ended up in a lake.
And you know what the king said? He didn't get angry. He said, Well, I know where to get another diamond. But I feel really sorry. That was all the treasure that Rabbi Isaac had. I feel very bad for him. I can afford to buy another diamond. So the guard took Rabbi Isaac home. And though he had given up his treasure, he had not broken a commandment. The door was a little bit open. And there was a man sitting on his bed. A man with long white hair and a long beard. And he spoke to Rabbi Isaac and he said, You have just lost a brilliant treasure. But you and your wife have been wanting a child for a long time. And so we have decided to replace one treasure for another. In 1 year's time, you and your wife are going to have a son. And he will end up making you very proud and be a brilliant treasure in your life. The man was none other than the prophet Elijah, who often appears in Jewish folk tales and brings about a miracle. And then the man vanished. True to his word, a year later, Rabbi Isaac and his wife had a little boy, and they named him Shlomo. So his whole name was Shlomo ben Isaac, and he turned out to be a brilliant treasure. Shlomo ben Isaac is known as Rashi, one of the great commentators of the Talmud that I was telling you about. He is one of the rabbis that is known for hundreds of years throughout the world. Every rabbi in every community all over the world knows of Rashi as one of the greatest commentators of one of the greatest books in the world, the Talmud. But Rabbi Isaac lived up to everything that he had been taught and could not be even a part of making the king's statue with his own diamond. Thank you. I've used all my time.
You are entertaining us so wonderfully, and you're sharing so many wonderful stories. Our sign language person is not here yet. Yes. Is this an imposition to ask you to share one more?
No, I'm not scheduled.
Would y'all like that? Would you like for her to do that? Thank you.
There's a favorite story I have about a man whose name is Herschel. Herschel was a tailor. Now, a tailor is, again, a profession that many Jews had to have because they weren't allowed to do many of the professions other people had. The in a community in Eastern Europe, the king or the czar declared who could have what jobs and who could do what professions. And the Jewish community was not allowed to have regular positions or own property and be farmers. So this man, Herschel, was a tailor. His wife was Rivka, and he was a very wise tailor. And people used to crowd in his shop not only to have their clothes mended, but to get advice. Some days his shop was so crowded with people getting advice, he talked more than he worked. Well, there was a man whose name was Samuel. Samuel lived in Warsaw, and he heard about the wise tailor, and he was quite a braggart. He had the biggest house, the richest food, the nicest clothes, and the biggest belly.
And he said, wouldn't I be the envy of everyone if I could invite Herschel, the wise tailor from Belchitow, to come and be at my daughter Hannah's wedding.
And so he sent a messenger with an invitation. And when Herschel got it, he closed his shop, ran home, and said, Rivka, I have been invited to this wonderful wedding in Warsaw. I've never been to Warsaw. I'm going.
But Herschel, you don't have the clothes to go to a wedding like that.
Well, they won't worry about my clothes. It says on the invitation that they're interested in me because I'm a wise man. I'll go with the clothes I have. And so he left for the wedding, and he was amazed when he arrived. The trip took no time at all because he'd never been to Warsaw before. And then he saw tall buildings. He saw lots of people. He was just amazed and looking around at everything when he tripped. And he fell flat on his face. And he tore his clothes. And there was mud all over his face and his sleeve was torn out of his shirt. He said, oh, I'll explain it to Samuel. He'll understand.